Hello, viewers and listeners. Welcome to another English language episode of FutureCast. My name is Isak Raltio. I will be your host for this episode. And in this episode, we are going to talk about, among other things, gang crime in Sweden, but also more generally. And I'm honored to have as my guest in this episode, Kristina Namdar, a visiting researcher at the University of Helsinki in the, what is Kasvatustieteet in English, actually?
Education Department.
Yeah. Great to have you on the show. And then from Stockholm, Diamant Salihu, journalist. You've written many books about gang crime in Sweden. You've covered the subject for many, many years now, and you're a very prominent voice in that subject over there in Sweden. So welcome to the show, Diamant.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with the basics, setting and giving a little bit of perspective of what we're talking about. Gang crime in Sweden has been a topic of discussion for many years now, but what is the actual scale of it? What do the numbers tell us? What are the most important statistics that you'd cite to sort of give some perspective about what's going on? Diamant, you can start.
It's still a constant high amount of deadly shootings that we have in Sweden. I think the number was 55 last year and 62 the year before. And what we see now is a high number of children that are involved in the gangs. They are shooting, they're detonating the explosives and being systematically used as some kind of a child soldiers. And I think that is a word that really suits the description, so we really understand how serious it is. And last year we saw a record number of young minors that were in custody for violent crimes linked to the gang wars that we have in Sweden.
Kristina, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree. One has to call it for what it is. And it is a sort of an honor culture for boys. Boys, young boys are pushing even younger boys, which are children. And we are talking about children. So this phenomenon for Sweden is even younger than it has generally been. Mm. I mean, it's always been. Gangs has been a younger thing. But with explosions and shootings, I mean, this doesn't even happen in London. So we have to understand the scale for a population of just 10 million concentrated to a few places. And, you know, historically it's been in a city thing, you know, big cities, and it is in big cities, but now it's in like small places around Sweden. Mm. You know, we've got, you know, Enköping, Norrköping, Eskilstuna, Sundsvall. We have lots of different places. Mm. And this is something, at least for me, seems to be quite new, that, you know, it's spread and it has become a very large scale thing. And, you know, yes, we've heard about it for the last couple of years, and it has been bad for many years. I think in Finland, the news has become the last couple of years kind of a big deal, but it has been going on in Sweden for a long time. And I think that's why it's also come to such a large scale, because it hasn't been dealt with in time. We didn't stop it when we could hear it at a very low level. We have to literally wait for explosions.
Yeah. The interesting part when I asked specifically about statistics is that there's a lot of way you can, spin a narrative, if you want to use those words, about when using statistics. Because on the one hand, I think it's true, maybe even in Sweden, that crime in general has been going down for, at least in Finland, in the past decades. But then, like, there's like violent gang criminality has seen a massive rise in many, many countries. Is this true?
That crime has grown in society in general, or amongst young people?
At least in Finland, in the US, I think since the 90s, there's been generally a trend down. But like, that's not to say that there isn't this massive influx of new types of gang violence.
I think it varies. It's a little bit more complex than that. Mm. I mean, Finland has a higher homicide rate in terms of like domestic violence under alcohol. So we shouldn't forget that.
Yes.
And gang crime is a bigger issue, let's say, in Germany. And I think Diamant can maybe sort of agree here, but they don't delegate it to small children who can make mistakes and draw attention to itself. So it is a phenomena that is, you know, but it has grown. And I think the general thing, if we just put gangs aside in general, and this is the trend in Finland, and many, many people are saying this, and many institutions are bringing it up, saying young people are resolving to violence to solve problems. So even if they're not in a gang, violence seems to be a tool that they seem to seem to think that they have, and they don't seem to have other tools. So there's something missing, of course. But I mean, we are at the verge of a third world war, if we're not already in one. I mean, the global context, the local context. I mean, there's a we're not in a very good context if we're going to analyze this from a moon perspective. We are in a situation of polarization and whatnot. And of course, young people are having to deal with all these very difficult questions. And the schools are not dealing with giving tools to solve conflict. I mean, conflict resolution is not something we teach in school.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Diamant can elaborate
in
on that.
In some schools, yeah, they do. Yeah, very hardly tough affected schools in one of the suburb areas in northern part of Stockholm, where they've had a lot of deadly shootings until now, because now it's quite...
Yeah,
quiet.
There are now schools, you know, like Frisuset and whatnot. They're trying to go in and talk about conflict resolution. But again, like on a larger scale, there is no culture.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't seem to know at a government level how we can deal with conflict resolution, nonetheless at an individual level. I mean, there are, of course, great examples. And I think Sweden now is in a situation where they're open to change and new ideas because our situation is so bad. So there are several examples across Sweden where they're now putting in positive examples of how to combat and prepare young people for society, to see the signs. Even in Stockholm region, they've come out with brochures to several schools, let's say in Haninge, about signs. If your kid's coming home with flashy clothes or, you know, seems to don't need money from you or is asking extra money from you, these things, you know, these are signs. And there is, of course, a general trend amongst young people also where they're also giving tips to each other on sort of how to avoid it. So there seems to be an awareness.
Yeah. Young boys honor culture and this sort of violence as a status symbol in a conflict resolution method. Very interesting track for this interview. I'm going to put a pin on that a little bit and get some. I wanted to ask you about gang criminality in Sweden. I read a little bit into the subject and something that seems to pop up very, very... sort of a special feature in Swedish gang violence. Obviously, we know that in other countries in Europe, they have street gangs. But as you said, in London, you don't see explosions in the same way as in Sweden. Why is it so especially violent in Sweden, Diamant? What do you think?
Compared to the UK, they have a huge problem with the stabbings.
Yeah.
Their problems, I mean... Oh, the equivalence here is the shootings, I would say. I believe that one of many reasons is that we've had radicalization within this environment. And why? One reason I would say would be that the police in Sweden has failed. The justice system has failed to prosecute those involved in the deadly shootings. For several years, we had only like 20-25% of the deadly shootings that were being solved, which led to more radicalization, specialization within the gangs. You could have sicarios, I mean, teenagers, young men being specialized as a hit men, taking jobs around Sweden to kill people. Because they had done it before and not been prosecuted. And that is one of the reasons. And then, of course, we have the social situation in Sweden with very segregated areas, segregated schools, and which has led to problems in these areas where we've seen many of these young teenagers, young men evolving and joining the gangs, being recruited to the gangs that are not gangs in the meaning that you maybe, if you live in another country where you have rockers with vests, not that kind of gangs, but more street gangs with no symbols. The only loyalty you have is that you are have grown up in the same area or have a family ties to that person, or you have a business together when it comes to dealing drugs or whatever. So not so loyal attachment either, which means that when you have a conflict, which they have all the time, they split up And they don't, I mean, the loyalty is very fragile this environment, which leads to a lot of chaos. And also in recent years in Sweden, we had also successful police operations, which has led to hundreds of leaders being sentenced to long sentences, which has also led to a chaotic environment because the leaders were like putting some kind of order in the areas where the gangs or the younger guys were active. And then when they were gone, new loyalties began to happen. They were starting to work for guys that were abroad, that were paying them to do these shitty jobs, killings and explosions. All these things are, I think, things that you have to put into consideration when you try to understand why we have this situation here in Sweden.
Yeah, specifically about that, I have a specific question relating to segregation in Sweden to both of you, but on the failings of the criminal justice system in Sweden and law enforcement, do you think is that mainly a lack of resources, a lack of willingness, a high standard in prosecution, or what is the failings from that side?
In segregation, you mean?
Oh, no, in the failings of the criminal justice system and like in the failings of the police to sort of prosecute arrest and prosecute.
Well, an explanation that is quite often given from within the police from different sources is that during the 2015, when several of these very violent conflicts were evolving in Stockholm, in Gothenburg, in Malmö, in our major cities. At that time, police did a big reorganization, which led to that those officers that really had the knowledge and the presence in our communities, they vanished.
Mm.
And so it became very quiet from these areas. So they lost the knowledge, and the guys that were troubled teenagers in the beginning started being more and more radicalized as criminals. At the same time as we saw this escalation in deadly violence, deadly shootings, explosions, the police force was given more and more resources, but it wasn't using them efficient enough. For example, it wasn't like quite often criticism that is quite often mentioned is that when they saw these shootings and the robberies and things happening that actually involved the same group of people, but these things were happening in different areas, then different local police officers were dealing with the problem instead of gathering all of these resources into some kind of a gang commission,
yes,
where you could have this view on
umbrella
everything
view.
Was going on.
Yeah.
The umbrella view, exactly. That is one of the reasons, and that also, some areas were really affected by the deadly shootings. So in one area, you could have, as in Järvaområdet, that is quite often mentioned in the suburb
areas. Rinkeby-Tensta is all under Järva, yeah.
In northern part of Stockholm, you had 9 deadly shootings only in 2021. That meant that all these, many of these, not all of the murders, but had to be handled by the officers and the investigators in the area that normally has to deal with these crimes, but they also have rapes and robberies and other kind of crimes that they need to deal with. But they were not recruiting enough investigators that they really needed based on the escalation of the violence. Mm. That is also a criticism that is quite often mentioned by the police officers, that there were not enough investigators, which means that they weren't using the money they got in an efficient way.
Yeah, there seems to be a systemic, and I emphasize this quite strongly, there's a systemic problem in Sweden. I mean, we know this and it's because of how it's been managed, but also how it's been run or not run in this case. Like Diamant said, in 2015, we closed down the sort of narcotics department, didn't replace it. That information disappeared. And this is something that is kind of shocking to neighboring countries like Finland. In addition to the fact that, yes, I mean, somewhere like in the UK, in Scotland specifically, it's been stabbing, and stabbing is actually more dangerous because you actually go to your target, you're close to it, you can damage their organs. Guns tend to be a little bit more, need skills, but then under that situation, you're by accident killing innocent people if you're giving a gun to a 13-year-old. The first thing that Diamant mentioned about them taking off the bigger, you know, gang leaders first created this kind of high chaparral cowboy system where now new people wanted to take over. So taking those without a plan was very dangerous because it just became this crazy shooting period that we saw. And then it went down and then it went up again. And again, we're talking about organized crime when we talk about gangs, but in this case, it's a very fragile, very loosely used word because it's not so loyal to a gang as a traditional gang, let's say, like, I don't know.
Cosa Nostra or something.
Yeah, it's not, Bandidos or Hells Angels or whatever. These are boys who barely know what they're joining sometimes. Yeah. And if they are, they're so fragilely offended and quickly can change from one group to the other. So it's a mess. And because we're sometimes, and naturally so, trying to solve this problem from a police perspective, and it is not just a police perspective. And in countries where they've been somewhat successful, like let's say Scotland, is when they haven't just focused on policing, controlling and punishing. They've had social workers, they've had schools, they've had parents, they've had a holistic view on sort of combating it. And they were even offered, in Scotland, would you like more police? And they said, no, we need more social workers, for example. So they have we have to have a holistic picture and all parts need to function for it to work. So we can't just talk about punishing. I mean, if we're punishing kids, we know that there's a 90% risk that they go back to crime. We know this because gangs, and in general, juvenile delinquency is not a new phenomenon. So if you look at America, we know that it's going to be a certain demographic group in prison, and the chances of them becoming more criminal, if they weren't, is going to go higher. That's why, for example, Norway has tried to come up with new ways of looking at sort of prisons, is to say that it's rehabilitating people back into society. And so we need to sort of look at this, if we're going to solve it once and for all, we need to look at this from a larger perspective. And Sweden has had a problem with delegating to a municipality level, regional level, schools and old people's homes. So we saw the effects of that during Corona. Privatizing schools, so kids are not getting the tools to actually finish high school, so they go for alternatives. And then taking in at the same time as we closed down in 2015, the narcotics department, we also took in a lot of foreigners, and not per capita, like more than Canada. So we took in a lot without any plan on how to integrate, and that people were coming from war zones with trauma, and this is generational trauma. And also if you're coming from a single parent where there's no father or there's a violent father, so what do we do? If you do a crime, like Diamant says, is there a serious punishment? I mean, just a few months ago, some of these big leaders who only got 2 or 3 years were coming back into the picture again. And so if you are brought up in an environment that is segregated, where it's normalized to sort of shoot and hear about shooting and gang and selling drugs, well, then that becomes your norm, especially for a child who's young and is a sponge just taking it in.
Yeah. So about the segregation, how did such country like Sweden, sort of my image of Sweden is a very egalitarian country, at least in its sort of forward-facing principles, how did it create such a segregated society? Is it like these macro projects like the Miljonprojektet, that where people just built these massive buildings outside of cities where you kind of just dumped people in, massive influx of people coming in? Or is it more social? Is it more person to person and cultural? Is there something about Swedish culture that is hard for a person to integrate to, especially if you're bringing some sort of historical trauma, as you say, generational trauma or
I think Sweden is an egalitarian society. I think Sweden is very, I mean, if I compare it to Finland and my experiences here, I find Sweden to be very inclusive. However, these areas are very segregated. But note that we're talking about 50 different cultures in Järva, at least. So who needs to integrate into whom? I live in Enskede, where Diamant has been to, and, you know, we will stand out than we would in Rinkeby, where there's a plethora of cultures. So, but yes, they are segregated from society. And I think it is, so from a sort of a... I don't know, you can understand this happening, that people will draw to each other. So if you look at Swedes and Spain, they have their own schools and they have their own köttbullar and they have their own restaurants. It's natural to sort of want to be around your own kind. In Thailand, Swedish people have their own schools. They hang out with their own, you know, at university, both of us has been to university abroad. We know that we'll hang out with the Scandinavian society, even though suddenly we're now united as one Scandinavian when we're in America or in England. Mm. So it is a natural thing to want to be around your own kind. But, and we know that, for example, these high buildings. So in Scotland, during Thatcher's time, they build these very high buildings. And if you are, from a practical point of view, in a crime, in a part of a gang, if you want to get out of it, it's very hard if you live in an apartment building where there's other members there, because you're going to see them every day. So in Scotland, one of the ways they combated it by was demolishing these high buildings and spreading people around Scotland and across the UK. Hmm. And this is not something that we're seeing happening in Sweden. In Sweden, they're trying to build now the Fokusjärva, the projects now that they're trying to work with is to look at the architecture and build beautiful high buildings. And in Malmö, when they've taken away these sort of so these kind of landlords that have not been very serious in their job, have not been investing back into the buildings. When they've taken away them, they've noticed that people are happier in their environments. However, it is not because of a rundown building why these kids are joining gangs. So going in with tens of millions of krona that they're doing now in Fokusjärva, I keep telling them that this was not the main reason. And if anything, by building new apartment buildings, because we're not talking about poor areas, you know, we're not like France and Belgium, you know, Sweden still is a welfare state. These kids, you know, they might have to move out because it will become too expensive. Stockholm is very expensive and it's very difficult to find accommodation. Very few people can afford areas where, you know, where we live. So it is automatically because of the system, again, a systemic problem, but it is not core. It's one of many problems. But I mean, in Kontula, and I've said this before, I was brought up in Vantaa and Puisto, which was in those days called Vantaa, another suburb, but now it's its own area. Kontula will have Finns who live there. There is a working class, if I'm going to use such a non-politically correct word. There is a working class. They're mixed, but in Sweden it is very segregated. Yeah. So you will not find many Swedes, very few. You might find a few Finns. Even Finns didn't feel welcome in Sweden back in the days when they were there. So I'm thinking that the problem of integration is not just on the foreigners necessarily too. It is, me and Diamant are brought up in very Swedish parts of the country. I was brought up in Växjö and you in Dalarna. So we had this opportunity to be surrounded by something so we could be part of it. Mm. But I mean, if you're in an area where it's only people of your own kind and own language, you don't learn Swedish necessarily as well, or you won't have the same opportunities. Many of the students that I've worked with across Stockholm, I've worked in Sätra, Skärholmen, Kista, which is part of Järva, and my students are from Rinkeby, Tensta. They don't know that they live by the sea. The archipelago is not known to them because they've been like a few times in town. So it is very sad, but it is not necessarily the main reason, but it is one of the solutions is to break this segregation. But again, we need to have people moving in different directions.
Yeah. What's your take on that, Diamant? What's Swedish segregation? There's a lot there.
I mean, it's very... I came to Sweden as a seven-year-old in the early 90s. And I grew up in an area where it was easy to integrate both me and my parents. In the same area today, you can see a huge change, where that area is very segregated, more homogenic as well. Today, it's a quite big Somali community in the area, which is also very isolated from the rest of the community, because in the local school, the parents that live in the big houses that surrounds that area, and parents not only with the Swedish ethnical background, but also my generation that has their own children going to school now, they move their children to other schools because they want to have more mixed schools. So you see this segregation in not only in the big suburbs, but also in smaller communities around Sweden. And I mean, a big reason we have the EBO-lag stiftningen that led to all those that could apply for asylum in Sweden could basically move wherever they wanted. because, I mean, many of them obviously wanted to live with people that spoke the same language, close to relatives and so on, which is totally normal, as Christina was describing. But that meant to, an increasing segregation, because these areas and some communities, some cities were not built to take in that many people. The schools were not structured for taking in a huge amount of children that needed to learn the basics from the beginning, the language and so on. And I mean, that has also led to this situation that we have now, that we now have like isolated islands around Sweden. And the majority society might not always be very welcoming to integrate and go there and just, hello, welcome, how can we make new friends? And obviously the same is for those that are living in these segregated areas that, can feel that they are living in a more parallel community next to the other community. And these two communities don't always have very natural ways to mix up, because the children go in segregated schools. The children, if they even do sports, they might do sports in clubs that also are very segregated too. So all those normal ways of meeting and integrating, I think, are less than they were when I was a kid. And it's not more than three decades ago. So this has happened quite quick.
So what's the difference then between Finland and Sweden in that regard? You mentioned Kontula, Vantaa. Is it just the pure amount of people and the lack of space?
Or? I don't think there's a lack of space. I mean, if you fly across from Helsinki to Stockholm, or if you fly from anywhere out of Sweden, you will see mostly forest and lakes, and the same thing is for Finland.
Okay,
isn't
in that
it?
Sense, there's space, definitely.
So there is actual space in the world. It's just that because of urbanization, people are moving in because there's more job opportunities. And like Diamant said, if you're, you know, if you've moved to a country, you want to be around people. But I mean, also, Stockholm is very, very difficult to find rentals if you can't buy.
Yeah.
It's very expensive. It took me 2 weeks to find something in, you know, Hakaniemi or Kallio, and it would be half the price at least than it would be in Stockholm. So, I mean, there's also that option. Yes, you might want to be around your own kind, but even if you wanted to move to Enskede, good luck, because that's even hard for a Swede. So it is very expensive, and this is an urbanization, this is an urban problem, but there is differences, and it is actually the amount also. I mean, and these things, just what Diamant was just saying towards the end here, these things take time to show in society.
Yeah.
So if in the 90s you privatize schools, so they become businesses, which we have in Sweden, and they're profit-making businesses, yes? We have many schools, and they specifically open in the suburbs because they get double the amount of money. And this is legal in Sweden. Mm-hmm. This does not happen in Finland or in Norway. And so this takes time to show in society. When you close down something in 2015, like a police department or a narcotics department, it takes time until it shows into society. So it takes time to develop a disease in that sense. It doesn't happen overnight. So people shouldn't be surprised. But it's small things that in the long term will add up and become a big problem. So Finland doesn't have as many foreigners, that's true. But Finland is also less used to foreigners. And so that the idea of the other is a very, you know, foreign phenomena. Racism is higher. What some things are openly said that you would never hear in Sweden. So, you know, even me and Diamant will get shocked over things that we will hear. So it's not there are differences, and yet at the same time, you can't say Sweden. I mean, Sweden has become a unique thing in Europe. But at the same time, if you look at the statistics, okay, yes, it's kind of sad that we have higher violence than Moldova, but we're not as high as, let's say, France and Belgium. So, I mean, our numbers are not. It's just if we compare ourselves to our neighboring countries, it's a very bad situation. But again, we shouldn't be comparing ourselves to El Salvador or Mexico City.
No. Yeah, I have a question specifically about El Salvador, actually. Maybe I'll just jump to that because you mentioned it. Well, first, to you, Diamant, because you're in Sweden right now. You're mainly based there and do your work there. We have seen Nayib Bukele, the new president of El Salvador, rise to power and do a massive, massive crackdown on MS-13 in El Salvador from a Western liberal perspective, by curbing, curtailing a lot of liberal values and freedoms, civic freedoms, arresting people en masse and putting them into these sort of holding facilities. And I'm not going to moralize over El Salvador's decisions to sort of crack down on the worst gang problem in the world in any way, but that sort of development in a country like Sweden or Finland would worry me, that you would get a political willingness to give up on civic freedoms and your own sort of civil liberties to sort of have a leader like this to crack down on a big problem. Do you think this problem could become big enough in Sweden that even Swedes would turn into a leader such as Bukele?
And I hope not, and I don't think so. If you look at some laws that have been accepted, you have the law that is called the preventive avlyssning, which means that you can basically listen to communication with.
Without suspicion.
Yeah.
Thank you. Without huge suspicion that person is really involved in criminality, but that person just needs to be around people that are involved in gang criminality. And I don't think that law would have been accepted that easily if you go back 10 years or so. But that is a result of the situation that we have here, and also tougher laws that are hitting, obviously, our gang criminals. And a few years back, we looked at Denmark as an extreme example, mm-hmm. how they dealt with migration and how their tough laws. But now we're looking at them and trying to learn from Denmark and their examples. I think if this continues like this, we will give away some liberties that we have now. Mm. But I don't think that we would go that far that El Salvador has done.
Yeah, no. And our problems were not as big as El Salvador.
No.
But yeah. I mean, El Salvador also has great examples of how to combat, sort of based on what I've been researching, mm-hmm. in terms of youth empowerment, using university students to get involved in villages. So there are good examples of that too, except their problem was so much bigger that they had to, Latin American statistics is, I think, like top 10. The crime rates are very high in most parts of Latin America, hence why they're also getting such leaders. It's not just look at Argentina. Look at other places. And it's the same thing here. I mean, those laws that Diamant was just mentioning about Denmark, that was coming from their SDP, their social democrats.
Yeah,
when I heard their suggestions about Rwanda and whatnot, I was like, oh, it must be their far right. And I was like, nope, that was that was their sort of middle range. And now we are also talking about those things that, migration should be maybe to an African country where we support them there. And that same discussion is happening here.
So what do you think? Is that a sort of quote unquote price worth to pay? Is that worth it?
Absolutely
for society?
Absolutely not. I don't think so? I don't say that it's right or wrong. If we want to have, migration and support countries in Africa at the same time, because some of, the poorest countries in the world are in Africa, like Congo and Malawi, Congo should be one of the richest countries in the world, technically. And colonization has had its damage and effect on those countries. And most of us in Europe are quite responsible for that. But I mean, if we could support them financially, but it's still not going to help the long-term problem. So there should be a plan for when you bring someone to your country. But this is not a problem of immigrants. Finland has first-generation immigrants. We're talking about second, third-generation, me and Diamant. We're talking about kids who are technically Swedish. And so what's wrong with the system? What's wrong with democracy that they actually find this more appealing, that they're not given that opportunity or they're not taking that opportunity, whichever way you look at it? But I mean, so you have to think that Sweden was the only country that didn't have a lockdown. Okay, so to talk about El Salvador, it wouldn't even work anyways, because we couldn't even implement, not just legally, but tell a Swede to not go out. We trusted that if we say don't have a party, that you won't have a party. Mm. But when people don't follow rules, sometimes you need to have harder laws. So I know that Mari Rantanen, I know that the Minister of Interior in Finland has talked about hard laws and soft laws, a combination. Mm. So if you're talking about the gang leaders, yes, I'm full on, put on hard laws so that there's a consequence for bad behavior. Like Diamant said, some kids were going on and doing these updrag, you know, to go and kill someone because they knew that there was no consequence the last time they did it. So, you know. Why not? If you do that and you get away with it. But then at the same time, you have to think about these younger kids, these ones who are underage, who are sort of not fully understanding what they're getting into by hiding drugs for a Pokemon card or whatever it is they talk about. That one cannot be combated the same way. Mm. But I mean, we have to put in laws that suit the society that it is. And unfortunately, they don't match right now. But laws alone is not the long term. Like I said, we have schools, we have parents, we have social workers. This is a complex issue. And so therefore, it needs to be, unfortunately, dealt with at that level too. A holistic problem needs a holistic solution. And so we naturally, of course, talk about police, but that is only one aspect of it. And so we need to combat this from a different angle. But I mean, I do see that the laws already now in Sweden, you can actually go and hur säger man nu när man ska visitera någon? So when you're going to check if they
frisk
body frisk. So my children who are half Swedish, my son was at the gym and two police asked if, you know, what he was doing. He immediately started to get asked. And this is going to be the problem, is that a lot of people who are not in any form in gangs or involved in crime are going to be asked. And that might, I mean, my kids hopefully will not feel like that, but that might push them the other way around. So they might feel like, hey, you know, I'm meeting this Swedish police and he's doing this to me, and they're going to go the other way. So we, you know, already in 3 weeks, one of the young boys I met at in Rinkeby Folkets Hus, he said, I've been already checked 3 times. And he works with getting kids out of gangs, but he's Somali. So, I mean, and I know this from, I mean, both me and Diamant know this, as foreigners in a country where you don't look, even though we are very, very Scandinavian in our ways, you know, I walk in Enskede, you know, I know that people might wonder why I'm looking at their house. I feel I walk into a store. So it can have an effect on you. I already felt that in Finland in the 80s, and it has changed a lot in Finland, but you still in smaller places, you do feel that you're a bit suspicious. And of course, it doesn't play to anyone's, you know, benefit when a lot of the crime is being done by people who look like me. So obviously, you know, I understand the suspicion, but if you're a young boy like my sons, they're like, but I've already, every time they get stopped by the police, I'm like, you're in Enskede, why? He goes, but there was something that had happened. The police asked me, they didn't look at my friends. And I said to him, well, you've not done anything, so why are you upset? So you have to have this conversation. And I think parents need to hear this so that they can talk to the kids and say, this is for the safety of society. So it's really not an easy question. No. We need harder laws, but it will affect us. So we need to be able to give up our own freedom for this to work. I don't know what you think, Diamant.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Is Denmark a good role model for Sweden right now?
At least Denmark has done something.
Yeah.
I mean, they were early to deal with the gang violence. Right or wrong, I mean, they don't have as many deadly shootings as we do, but they have a lot of criminals. They have rockers, but they have around 1,225 rockers. And according to the latest numbers here in Sweden, we have around 62,000 people involved somehow in the criminal environment.
Yeah.
Obviously, and not that all is actually of them by are organized.
And that statistics actually showed that you had to have several affiliations for that to be considered that you had an affiliation. So it wasn't like those 62,000 had just one anknytning. They had several anknytning. They had several affiliations to a gang. So that statistics is probably even higher if we wanted to broaden it.
Oof.
Well, what I think is, I mean, it's worth to mention in this topic is because a lot of focus, especially when I speak to fans, it's like they see the migration as a main problem, and I mean that might be a part of the problem dealing with how to deal with people that migrate to your country and how to integrate them and all that. But what we see in Sweden at the moment is Another involvement, which means that we see middle-class Swedish kids with a Swedish ethical background, boys and girls, important to mention, that are involved in these gangs and committing the murders, detonating the explosives, building the bombs, transporting guns, transporting drugs, and so on. So, I mean, as Tina mentioned, I mean, those that are involved now in the worst crimes, they might be second, third generation kids. So, I mean, how can we have third generation murderers in our society that choose that career? That is a more important thing to discuss. And I think that's a part of the explanation is the huge social problems that we have with segregation and all that we have already discussed.
Yeah.
Because these guys, often guys, can very often have family members that have chosen totally different paths. Brothers and sisters that work in schools that are high educated, that are, very well adapted in our society, doing their best to do everything right. And then they have these siblings that are doing the opposite. And when I ask them, when I meet them and ask, why did this happen to you? They never blame the society or their parents. They say, I choose this because, and then they take the examples that they have a brother or a sister that is a lawyer, whatever.
So, and that's very interesting.
Choice,
that the fact that you are choosing. I mean, as a child, I think, you know, there are other aspects, I'm sure, that they're not aware, that they're not conscious of. But that's very, the majority of foreigners in Sweden are law abiding. This is something we could not forget. Yeah,
of course.
The majority of foreigners, whether second, third generation, are very integrated.
A vast majority.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And especially in Sweden, we have several ministers that are Persian descent. We have, look at me and Diamant, we are of foreign descent. We've sort of integrated. We are law abiding. So the majority are, and nobody's interested in that to research that part. We're interested in that 1% that, or now it's of course a larger percent in Sweden, that are doing wrong. But I mean, they're choosing, and it's exactly that. We don't have just middle class, we even have upper class, kids coming from very posh parts of Stockholm that are coming from also certain backgrounds, maybe one or two parents, but it is not the vast majority, of course, is in these suburbs, but we do have now middle class and even upper class. And none of on a global scale, even the suburbs of Stockholm, we are not poor. Yes, we are not poor. You're entitled to a home in Sweden. There is all that. So it wasn't a socioeconomic, but it could be other opportunities. And many of them actually stand up for it and say, I chose this and I can't blame, which I think in some ways is sort of admirable that they're aware of that. But at the same time, it would be interesting to understand why is it that four kids didn't and the one kid did.
Yeah, that's very interesting. There's so many questions to pick from here and a limited amount of time. But since we're on this subject right now, do you think how does sort of mainstream society relate to this? Do you think we have a healthy or an unhealthy attitude towards this culture? Because it seems like gang culture, these segregated communities stand in a very stark contrast to a lot of mainstream society. And that also causes some like selective romanticization of this sort of, gang crime through pop culture maybe, or through other types of sort of media. And do you think this validation, this kind of disconnected validation, where a lot of like middle-class people get to sort of enjoy in this culture, sort of pick bites and parts of it that they think is maybe cool and exciting and a bit of rebellion towards mainstream society, but don't have to deal with the consequences of the actual violence. Do you think that's a part of it? Or
I think in Sweden, for sure, the reason why it wasn't dealt with in time, like Diamant was saying, was because it didn't affect somebody who lived in Enskede. I mean, when they started talking about it, I was like, what? This has been going on for years. You know, and then when Einar got shot in like Hammarby Sjöstad, I'm not saying that's a factor, but I mean, when it got closer to home And now, you know, we're so used to, I don't think we realize it, but to have a helicopter flying above your apartment, me and Diamant are used to that in Stockholm. That's very natural. To see police everywhere, it's natural. So we have, we're in it. So when you're in it, it becomes normalized. Mm. But I mean, it is an issue, in my opinion. But I don't know, Diamant.
Yeah, what do you think, Diamant?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people really have opened their eyes in the recent years because of these reasons that were mentioned. And I mean, I think that during too many years when everything was happening in suburbs with affecting people with a Somali background or with another kind of background, foreign background, that was not a main problem, not a national problem. But when it came closer to more of us, then it became a big story in the media instead of just being some music that you could listen to and think that that was cool music or see a series in television as regarded as something fascinating. Mm. Then all that became a reality for more and more people. And that's where we are today. And that's where we are today with also with children from a middle-class background that are enrolled, parents that I speak to every week that have a Swedish background and they have good jobs and they're like expressing their frustration, like my kid is involved, my kid, my son is part of the problem. And I mean, it's not only those problems that don't speak Swedish. So I think it has become much more relevant for all of us. And I think that today nobody can shut their eyes. And I think we are in a position in our society where we understand the problem. Mm. We are very aware of what's going on, but we are just fumbling in the solutions. Mm. And I hope
or blaming others.
or blaming others as well. But I think that even blaming others, blaming migrants is not, I mean, it's not an opinion that really attaches anymore in the way that it did a few years back. Mm-hmm. Because now I think more people are aware that their kids are also part of this as consumers of drugs or active shooters. Mm-hmm. And that we are in a situation where we are doing stuff here. Not sure if that will lead to anything, any solutions, but I think that we are moving forward. And I hope really, of course, that we in a few years will be in a position where we can look back and have a more normal criminality. And I don't think this will vanish total, but I think it can be much more normal in a way that we can compare to each other in the Nordic countries.
I think for Finland to look at this phenomenon and try to figure, to learn something from Sweden is good. The way Finland has hyped up gangs, I wish they would have hyped up, you know, racism and other issues that existed or alcohol problem in this country. I mean, I'm not saying that they haven't, but the way that it became a bit of a cool thing. And I think sometimes if we focus on the not so cool things, we might not get these negative effects. Mm. And it's just much more cooler to say, oh, you know, it's gangs. And of course, amongst the kids, from their perspective, there is a culture.
Yeah.
It is normalized. There is music. There's rap. You wear the Gucci hat and the keps or whatever, you know, the kids want to look like each other and it is normal for their age group and it has become a cool thing. And the music industry and the media, of course, everybody plays a role. But at the same time, we are talking about children and that we do have a responsibility as adults. We do have a responsibility as civilians of a society together to combat it. And that's why I think that if Finland is in a position where they're not suffering as much, then I have advice to say, well, we need to then support Sweden. We need to give advice on education and whatnot. If Finland has such a great education system, Why can't we not support? Finland, Sweden has been in a position to support Finland in times of war. And this is really our kind of war. And we haven't had the same history. We're culturally very similar, but we have very, very different experiences. And of course, we have had more diversity for a longer period of time than, let's say, Finland. So there has to be some kind of collaboration in how we can combat this problem. And again, it's not one solution, it's several solutions. So I think Sweden is actually becoming the land of opportunity. It's becoming the new America. It's the America of Europe, in my opinion. It's where there's all this multiculturalism. And because of all these problems, now, or like a few years ago, if I was saying something very utopian in someone's eyes, they'd be like, oh, you know, not interested. Now, when I suggest really what I would think as a, you know, participatory of young people in society and doing positive things, the mayor is like, yeah, whatever, go ahead. Because we are so desperate in Sweden for some kind of solution that everything, and that's why it's the land of opportunity. You come to Sweden and now everybody's trying to sort of work together because it's affected everyone. So in some ways, media has played a good role in highlighting this problem.
About gang mentality, I know we have to let you go at some point, Diamant, here soon, but I want to ask you about this thing called gang mentality. And now I'm not a young man anymore, but I remember being a young man in my early 20s and my sort of late teens. There's a lot of like surface level stuff related to, like, I don't want to say gang culture directly, but the sort of brotherhood mentality with fashion, money, status and stuff that like really hacks the male brain and our sort of reward systems. It's really easy to remember, to relate to times when you could feel like, okay, this is something that I want to belong to. But then obviously I wouldn't pick that path in life for myself, because I realized the dark sides of it is that I'm probably not going to live until I'm 30. It's a very volatile market. I'm not going to learn any necessary skills necessarily for like a normal work life. And there's a lot of other stuff in a quote unquote normal life that I find very, very valuable now. So what is it that drives young kids towards this sort of, gang mentality, and sort of recognizing that the fact that, yeah, I mean, there are some things there which universally every single young boy can recognize as being attractive.
I think the closest comparison I can get to is the skinhead culture or the punk culture, but this involves a very radicalized generation. I mean, those that are entering the gangs or joining them are very aware of what they're being part of, that they need to be ready to kill somebody or be killed. And there's been a hype around this gangster culture through music, through, of course, through media too. We play a part in this situation. But why does a teenager want to be part of this? I think that is, I mean, a failure of our system in many ways. And I don't really have an explanation to that, but I can see that a lot of teenagers, both boys and girls, they want to be part of this. We see that in many investigations. And the way that they're recruited is quite often through social media. I know examples where other teenagers are just posting a status on Instagram and saying, well, we're looking for workers. And children that are on institutions or in their rooms in their villas, they see this and they know what that means. And they respond and they join people that they have never met for small money. And they join terrorist cell groups, basically, ready to commit a shooting against people that they don't even know. Just because somebody says to them that this is the right thing to do. I think that is very dangerous. And also, I mean, maybe the easiest way to try to understand that why maybe it's to look to ISIS or any extreme group that we can refer to understand that there is such a power that is different and difficult to understand many times that attracts some people.
Hmm.
And how do we deal with that? I mean, we need to arrest people that are recruiting, obviously, and we need to deal with those that are being recruited and give them other options.
Yes.
And be aware of that they are able to be recruited.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it's really fascinating. And because obviously, yeah, you can arrest people who do recruiting and stuff, but there's some pull. There's some force that pulls. Maybe we're just such social beings that we're looking for validation from the people that are closest to us.
I think we have to look at the context. So Diamant mentioned culture.
Yeah.
And I think culture plays a big role. What kind of culture is around you? We have several cultures going on right now, yes? And we have the digital tool, which Diamant brought up too, which is we're not quite sure what's happened, but something's happened. Gambling. A lot of these young boys who are joining gangs are trying to maintain some kind of an addiction. They also have been gambling. And this is a big problem in Sweden amongst young men that people are not talking about, unfortunately, because some of the boys that I've been speaking to in Rinkeby say that they have addiction problems, whether it's just snooze and maintaining that, or whether it is that they've been playing, because the digital tools allow you to. And in Sweden, if you watch an advert in Sweden, and Diamant will confirm this, I have never seen anything like this in the world. You will have 10 ads, of which 5 is SMS loan. You can just text and get a loan. Mm. And the other 5 are gambling. And this is absolutely ludicrous that, you know, that you can go online and have your pull your money out. And then online, you'll download a game and then you can, you know, play or gamble. And so everything's done on this tool. We know that the algorithms show you already what you believe in. So you don't learn about diversity and you're fed whatever you want. They're able to recruit. So kids go online and there's this mis and disinformation where they're, you know, even facts are not even now facts, you know, and we talk about fake news. So but they're exposed to this culture, this digital tool, where they live in parallel universes, where one that is digital and connected, and then in society where it's extremely segregated and disconnected. Mm. And at the same time, we live in this culture of contest, where we're number one happiest country in the world, number one in PISA. And then where there's winners, there's losers, and nobody wants to be the loser. We're in a culture of protest, where young people are out in the streets protesting. Mm-hmm. Against war, against the climate change, taking those big questions much more seriously than we adults. And we know that the institution of the family broke. We know that the institution of society has become more polarized. We're more marginalized, or certain groups are. We also know that in the last 100 years, I mean, we've taken democracy for granted. We assume democracy is there and that these values are there. Where are we promoting them? Where are these kids learning anything of any value? It was the role of the family before. It was the role of religion, actually, before. And when we threw away religion sort of from society, with all the right reasons, there was blind faith and dogmatism, but we threw the baby with the bathwater or the bassin water. There was something good. There was something about promoting morals and values that even the police in Sweden, Karin Hjertblad, talks about. We need to have morals and ethics and these things brought to children, because clearly we can't assume that if you come to Sweden, just you get the opportunity, you will live a peaceful life. If you've come from war, you'll bring war. If you're born into society, in a family, in Sweden, where your father's an alcoholic and you get hit and you don't learn anything of any value that could, this is right and this is wrong, well, of course, you cannot expect much more. Mm. So these kids are in a context, usually, especially these kind of kids, are in a very negative context. It's, you know, some of them are coming from families, but there has been something that's been wrong. Some of them are chosen, but the younger ones haven't. The sort of younger kids are not fully aware of the long-term consequence.
Yeah. Diamant, I assume I have to let you go now. It's a bit past 12.
Yeah, I need to catch a taxi that is waiting for me.
Okay, we'll go run after it then. Yeah, sorry for keeping you up.
Thanks for having me. Very interesting discussion.
Thank you so much. Diamant, for joining.
This was
an honor and pleasure. Bye.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
It sort of balances itself out because he has one perspective and I have another. But yet we still somehow meet on the common ground.
Yeah.
We always sort of agree because, and that's how we actually, the first time we met, it was like that. He said, I told my mom that, you know, what she's saying is exactly that. And so it was nice for, it was a nice confirmation for me because I work in schools. So I, of course, see kids and parents. And he also meets kids and parents. Sometimes academia is just someone in this kind of, you know, Minerva building at the top of a castle, very far away from reality, but they're analyzing something that they know nothing about. And so I think it's important to have diversity at a university, at an academic level, on having journalists, having, you know, I love to work with THL, Sisäministeriö, Oikeusministeriö, Helsingin kaupunki, and have different perspectives because it is a holistic problem. We need social workers, we need doctors, we need parents involved. I mean, there is some of the advice that I would give to Finland, and I have been giving it, is that we need to get parents involved. Parents are the first educators. They have the first 5 years. So early childhood education is very important. The first 5 years is avgörande. It's actually crucial to the child's well-being. So coming in when they're already radicalized or an extremist or they're in a gang, it's kind of late. I'm not saying we should give up, but it is very late. So we need to be preventing these things way before we even see signs of it.
Now, you mentioned three massive things there. You mentioned the family unit and moral values, like stemming from the family unit. I don't know, like it sounded like you were referring to like Judeo-Christian values. I don't know if that's exactly what you're referring to. But you mentioned religion as well, which is also interesting. And then you mentioned, I mean, I guess society in general, not teaching or having this sort of collective sense of, I guess, civic duty or whatever you were talking about.
I mean, what else is the context of Sweden and Finland? Is that they're very secular societies, very individualistic societies. Yeah. And who comes here? Who do we have here if we're looking at the migrant? Very collectivistic, very religious. They have another view on society. So we have this contrast, and both are important. We should have, we as a Scandinavian should have a more collectivist. We should think of our communities, you know, of our nations. But at the same time, we need to also take our moral duty. So the Swedish system wasn't wrong to say, hey, if you're told not to go to a party during Corona, you should not go. And that should be on you. We should be mature enough to be able to make such decisions. So I think religion, I think one aspect, and that's part of my research, is that there seems to be something lacking in democracy or in society that the kids are appealed to fill this void. And when we have looked at a child in whatever negative outcome, whether it be gangs, juvenile delinquency, or bullying or whatever, we've missed the aspect that, and in Finland, we've focused a lot on socio-emotional and emotional, you know, sort of capital of the child, which is important. And not to say that emotions aren't, but we've missed this sort of spiritual, this existential aspect of the child, the sense of meaning and purpose, which a lot of these young boys are looking for.
And not just in gangs. I mean, I'm a secular liberal, and I do like our society based on individual freedoms. But I mean, there does seem to be an sort of vacuum left from, I don't know what it is. Is it losing a unified religious community or just this lack of purpose? And you see this both in young men that are not even involved in any gangs, just young guys in general, many of them.
Exactly. A lot of people tell me, oh, well, it's, you know, foreigners. No, it's not. We have also mental health issues in our own community. Yeah. We have one in three, according to THL, one in three girls have mental health issues. We know that's an internalizing problem, yes? So that's an internal conflict I'm taking care of. It can, of course, show itself in other forms too, externally. Then we have, of course, gangs, which, of course, destroys the community. It's an externalizing issue. But we have to look at the holistic aspect of it. Mental health, if you look at mental health reports, the big ones that the UN do, in detail, when the young person describes what is bothering them, they talk about being lonely. They talk about wanting more autonomy, more action, wanting to find their purpose and meaning in life. So therefore, mental health is perhaps an existential quest. Yes. And at the same time, when you ask young people who are radicalized or joining gangs, they are also looking for this sense of cohesion, being part of a group.
And many of them have found it there, right?
They have found it there. But the thing is that as soon as you feel a Christian or part of a gang, or when you feel a cohesion with one group, you're automatically at odds with another.
Yeah.
Okay. So as soon as I'm a Christian, then you're a Muslim, and then we have different ways of seeing life after death, for example. And so we need to find a common ground, and young people want to find that. And I think mental health issues is our problem. That's the majority. It's not actually gangs. It's majority have mental health issues. And that's why I've tried to ask a deeper question that yes, gangs, we know that education is important for them to finish, you know, gymnasia, high school, upper secondary school, lukio is important. We know that to speak a language is very important. You need to learn Swedish. You cannot be in Sweden for two or three generations and not learn it. There's something wrong with the system if that has allowed for it to happen.
That's actually really insane.
It is insane.
It's really crazy to think about, like, how... It's like learning to communicate in a country is one of the... Or just as a human...
And it is frustrating if you cannot.
Yeah,
if you cannot,
for both sides. Yes, yeah, exactly.
It's very frustrating to not be able to make yourself understood.
Yeah.
If you ask me to explain my emotions in Finnish, I might struggle, you know. But and it would be very frustrating for me.
If that was your only way to communicate with
Finn, if that was my only way. But I mean, at the same time, there must... I mean, I can understand when adults can't learn, especially Finnish language. You know,
so
I learned it as a child. It was very different. So it was easy for me. And I
went to... For us.
It's easy for us to say that. But I learned it as a child and I went to Finnish school, which I'm very grateful to my father that he forced me to, because I could have gone to a Swedish-speaking school. But if you come here at over, you know, 16, 17, 18, as an adult, it is very, very difficult to learn a new language, nonetheless Finnish.
So one thing that I've heard mentioned, actually, this was Diamant when I listened to some of his interviews, that for Swedish citizenship, and maybe for also some other, I guess, like civic...
duty?
Not duties, but... benefits. I'm not sure, but there was hardly any requirements for language put on anyone, which in one sense I can imagine was delivered as a sign of compassion. We don't want to impose too much of our local culture on you so that you can preserve whatever you brought with you, which is a beautiful and a very nice thought, I think. Then on the other hand, I mean, putting responsibility on someone else to do something is also a sign of love. If I went to a workplace and on day one they told me, "Welcome, all right, here's your desk," and then figure stuff out, I would be like, "What are you? What?" But if they told me, "Hey, here are some tasks," okay, now I feel meaningful. Now I feel like I have a purpose here. Now I feel like I have something to do.
And well, that's the thing with kids too. As a parent, you don't just let your kids do whatever you want to. And I think this is one aspect of Sweden that has been sort of, they've misunderstood freedom. And I think this is for generally for Western society and in general in society globally, actually, that freedom does not mean that you can do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. Freedom means that I can develop myself to my best potential. The virtue of freedom is that you are able to develop yourself as a human being and that you're free to do that, not to do whatever you want, to come home 3 a.m. or shoot someone. That's my freedom. And if you let people to decide, of course, they can naturally keep to their own group, hang out with their own friends. But if you force a child, you say, well, you need to have friends. You need to get out of the house. You need to do things. And we need to do this with adults too, unfortunately, is to say that, you know, there are rights in society, but there's also obligations. So to be a citizen of a society, you have to say, well, what can I contribute? I can't just take something without giving. And what can? And that's where you find meaning and purpose.
And that's the baby in the bathwater that maybe you were talking about earlier, that, like, I would obviously, again, I'm a big supporter of liberal freedoms and values. I think there's so much value in creating a society like that, because it allows for the type of positive growth that you were mentioning. But maybe we did throw the baby out of the bathwater, and in some sense that
it's an existential crisis. There's a crisis of identity. There's an existential crisis amongst the majority of young people from rich countries. I mean, how come is it that this is not coming from Malawi, that I don't know my sense of purpose? It is a luxury to say, I don't know how I feel. I don't know who I am. I'm trying to find myself. That's because you've got time. My father always said very nicely that 1% of society has all the money and the power in the world. They're never going to give it up. 90% of society is so poor that they're just trying to make ends meet. The responsibility is on us 9%. And I think we took our democracy for granted. We thought everybody in the world just didn't have the opportunity to be good. And so we didn't promote it. And I think we need to understand that what we have in Finland, what is Finnish, what is Swedish, what is fundamentally human, it's a global phenomenon to be a good and honest person. This cannot be taken for granted, and we need to promote it. We need to educate it in school. Mm. It needs to come back into school. It needs to be put into families. And if you look at countries like Iceland and Scotland, countries which have been able to combat issues amongst young people. So Iceland had an issue with alcohol with young people under the age of 16. Mm. As a united nation, which Finland is, by the way, more than Sweden, so the potential is here too. They said, okay, we have this problem, and it's an island problem. A lot of crime is in islands, yes? So mm-hmm. we know that the death penalty in Jamaica, Papua New Guinea has been very high because these are small communities where it's very difficult to get out of them. Mm. So Iceland had this problem with alcohol. They decided collectively, and we know in football how united they are with their football, they decided, we're going to educate kids in school on the effects of alcohol. We're going to educate the parents. We're going to bring in experts into the schools. We're going to bring police in school. We're going to put a curfew that you cannot be outside after, let's say 10 o'clock if you're under the age of 16. We're going to also add good things. We're going to talk about having a family dinner with the family together. We're going to put out recipes and support them to give them a way to sit down around the table and communicate with each other so that they don't feel that they want to go out and drink. We're also going to force parents to spend time and force the kids to go do activities, sports activities, activities in nature.
What do you mean force? Like,
well, they would pay them. No, they would actually pay them because they knew that they weren't going to, especially maybe get the fathers on board to go and hang out with their kids. So they said, we're going to pay both parents. And they were given money to go and spend time. They made it available to do lots of activities. And this kind of Icelandic model, this harrastus, this hobby thing has come to Finland. Finland is also very quick in putting in policies. Sweden is very, very slow. Mm. So in Finland, if you suggest something, it very quickly comes in.
Did you hear that, Finnish listeners?
Yeah. Finland is very fast compared to Sweden. In Sweden, nobody decides because it's individualism at its... We didn't even have a government for a while because nobody could decide who was who. So I like the Finnish model where we decide and we're proud of who we are. Hmm. We're proud to be Finns. And Finland has developed a lot since the 60s, 70s and 80s. It's a very diverse society. Hmm. We can't compare ourselves to Sweden. We don't have the same history.
Yep.
But I mean, and Finland isn't as homogenous as we think. We've got Samis, we've got Roma, we've got Jews, we've got Tatars. So we have a diverse group. Hmm. And I think we need to promote what is good. And I think this needs to be, and I actually have spoken to several people, and this has been my own view, that we really need to unite on this problem. When the Eduskunta, when the Finnish parliament came to Sweden, I said, my wish for you is that you all unite in your parties and combat this and not blame each other and say, oh, it's perussuomalaiset or it's this one. You need to unite and find a common ground to combat all these negative outcomes. And the same thing is, every single institution in Finland or NGO is trying to be the one who solved the problem.
Yeah.
And they're not communicating with each other. Every academic group is trying to be the first one. There's no team play. Mm. And this culture has to change if we're going to solve it.
Man, this reminds me of an example of these sort of two struggling worldviews that I have shuffling around in my head. When I was 19 and I did my military service here in Finland, the mandatory one, mm-hmm. conscription service, I was sort of on principle, sort of rebelliously against it on a political level. Like, my government shouldn't be allowed. They're infringing my individual freedoms to make me do this, take out a year of my life and serve and do something that I haven't made a free choice to do. And to some extent, I mean, yeah, sure, there's an argument there. I can understand why people would say that. And like, a government that has power to do that, it can easily be abused. Mm-hmm. But there's something so remarkably beautiful about an experience where you bring, at this point, guys mostly, but also some women together from the working class to the upper class. Everyone puts on the same suit mm-hmm. and you work on tasks together.
Yes.
No one even, you probably forget the background of your friend unless mm-hmm. you then get to know them later. But like, in that moment when you're working on a task together, you're one team, one unit. And I think there's something really, really beautiful about that.
Spot on. It's one of the things that I've been promoting in Sweden, that the military service or the civil service or military service should come back. In fact, I think it should be service to society. Mm. One of the motions that I helped write and I suggested to the Member of Parliament, who's now the Deputy Mayor of Stockholm, was that university students should be putting X amount percent of their time into society. And they should be getting either credited or paid for it. I think credits would be great. Because it's a model that comes from Bolivia, actually. They had a huge amount of problems, and they were having problems in the villages, and there was a big sort of gap between rich and poor. So the universities there started to say that any course that you're doing, you have to put X amount of hours in the village. Mm. And that's a wonderful model. So the same model, we said, even if 2% of universities in Finland would allow for their young people to get credits in putting service into society. But the military service, I think for boys especially, but even girls, mm-hmm. I think it is a wonderful thing. Like you said, you come in, you're stripped of your background, you're one, you wear the same outfit. And if you want to play with guns, this is what I say in Sweden, if these boys want to play with guns, varsågod, go ahead. But do it in a way where you're at least defending your country or something. I'm not for war. I'm actually against it. But there's something very good to learn discipline, to learn that, because the parents are not teaching this. Again, you have to do certain things and you have to get out of your comfort zone. And whether it's civili palvelu or military service, whether it's civil service, it's important. So I think, and Sweden is beginning to realize it just because of the context that we're in, that we realize that we don't have the manpower to defend ourselves. Finland has a great manpower. We are very good in our airplanes and our sea sort of military, but we don't have the manpower. And if you ask kids in the suburbs, would you defend your isamma, your father, fathers, they would not defend Sweden. And that's very sad. And there's also a question there. If you're coming from immigrant backgrounds, and we can call them third culture kids, even though they're more complex than that. If you don't identify with your parents' culture and you don't identify with your host culture, then what are you? Well, in my opinion, you're the perfect candidate for global citizenship. Because we talk about global citizenship. I feel like a global citizen. I feel like I'm from Kangasala. I feel very Finnish and I'm proud of it. But I'm also Swedish. And I'm also Finnish Swedish, and I'm also Persian, I'm also Baha'i. So I have all these levels, and I think that the more we identify with globally, the less we'll at odds with others.
Yeah, there's something very interesting there, like how to separate the idea of nationalism from this sort of stark contrast, or at least some sort of like value based hierarchy, like we are better than the other people, or like they are our. Enemies. I mean, nationalism or a sense of, I sometimes compare it to a love of parents. Like I like and love my parents a lot, but objectively, there might be better parents out there, but I love them because they're mine and I didn't choose them as my parents.
That's a very good example.
But it's just, that's how it, and it'd be weird if you asked me like, do I love my parents? I was like, well, yeah, I mean, in some sense, yeah, I appreciate them. But if I look at the statistics, there are definitely better parents out there. So like in a relative sense, it would be weird to answer like that. But in one sense, it might be true. But then on a more existential level, I realize these are the cards I've been dealt with. Very appreciative of what I've been dealt with. And there's some value in that.
Yes.
But okay, I want to ask about, you mentioned honor culture in the beginning. And this is one type of bathwater that a lot of kids are now, if you missed that analogy, it's because we've been using the baby out of the bathwater analogy. Maybe I should rephrase myself. One culture or sort of one type of acting within a group that young people, young men, a lot of them are attracted to, is this sort of status-seeking honor culture. And again, maybe a lot of kids, a lot of boys can relate to this. There's a lot of honor stuff on a very mild level in many, many, many friend groups of guys, I guess, mostly. But it is very pronounced in these sort of criminal gangs. Do you agree or not?
And yeah, I mean,
where does that come from?
Well, there's several aspects here. We look at context, so context of materialism. We are in a culture of materialism where we promote look out for yourself. So, of course, wanting status and money. And you look at the music videos, it's all about, you know, money. And what is our definition of a successful person in society? Just the average person, ask anyone. Well, someone who's got a stable job, a good income, a house. You know, we're not too different. We just do it a bit more subtly. So, you know, a professor might want an income from some kind of Academy of Finland, and then someone else might want to get it some other way. And if they don't feel that they have the same opportunities, they'll go get it somewhere else.
Yeah.
If you feel that I'm not going to finish school and I don't have 8 years to go and do that to maybe maybe get a job, maybe be accepted. I mean, I've had to work very hard and I'm still not, I feel, accepted in any ways, but my acceptance is not dependent on others. And I have that inner reflection. I think that this ability to reflect within is a very important one. And we don't talk about it. We talk about critical thinking when we try to combat these issues, that they need to be critical about who's coming their way and what are they reading online. So an inner reflection, and you've just reflected really well throughout this whole conversation about yourself and your family and who you are and everything and your issues. And so to have that ability is an important one. To be able to have dialogue like we're having right now, that we that me and Diamant do really nicely, but we talk to each other and we can converse. But to be able to talk with someone with a different way of thinking is also very important. Mm. Now, the context also for Sweden and for Scandinavia is a very feminist society. Mm. So what happens to that toxic masculinity that if I compare, I can only speak of my own culture, let's say Persian culture, where the man is the one who is, you know, it's my word, and they can be quite violent, a lot of these fathers. So,
but I would even phrase that in a more good faith, even though, like, I probably agree with a lot of this, but, like, it's a sense of pride and honor and a sort of...
And if you haven't found your place, that becomes even more important.
Yeah. So they wouldn't say, this is toxic masculinity.
No,
they would say,
no.
This is my role and duty.
Yes, and in fact, I'm doing him a favor. I'm teaching him about honor. But, I mean, it is... And some of it is accurate, and some of it is important. Now, of course, a lot of these boys don't have fathers. Mm. So what male role models are there out there? There's more female teachers. So we need more male teachers. We need more male role models. And we need to ask ourselves, do we have anyone in our community that's a single parent that might need a support as a man? But I mean, that's a sort of a, again, a utopia. Someone who knows how to reflect like yourself, yes. But in Sweden, for example, this honor culture for boys has been older boys who are quite lost, pushing younger boys. And even between Finland and Sweden with the gangs, we know that it's been, for example, with Somali families who have been cousins with each other communicating. So some older brother or older cousin has influenced another one. Mm. So boys, of course, have an influence on each other. But what we've missed, I think, is that a lot of these people who have come to Sweden, for example, the men have not found themselves and they've been sort of neglected. And I would say that even in general in society, men are quite lost. I mean, you have to be very careful what you say now, because there'll be a Me Too against you, and you have to be very careful how you talk and we know, I mean, we have good eyes. We have the good lens to say we stand up for women's rights, even though it's not even fully equal even in our societies, but we have that lens. So when we see an honor culture, we focus on the woman. She's the victim. But in actual fact, the real victim is the perpetrator. If you are 12 and you're shooting, you are a victim. If you're an ISIS boy raping and killing a Yazidi girl, you are a victim. You too are a victim. In fact, you're more of a victim, because it is not normal to want to kill at that age. So we need to see the boy here, the boy that's kind of missing. And we need to figure out, you know, that this is an honor culture for boys. We don't talk about it. Mm. And a lot of these boys have a very toxic, and it is because of their environment, and they lack this kind of being in touch with their feminine side. So the Swedish boy, the average guy from Södermalm, is very different to the Finnish man. Even the Finnish man would feel very different to the Swedish guy, yes? So Swedes are a very, you know, the average Swedish guy is a very modern, by modern definitions, a very modern, in touch with his feminine side, very comfortable with wearing nail polish and still feeling very straight. Mm. So, I mean, it's a very different to the Finnish. So even Finland here, there's a difference. But if you speak to a lot of these kids who have, or in the suburbs, a lot of the men are very happy to go back to Iraq or Somalia or go back home. And they even threaten their kids that I'm going to send you back home to their boys. But the women and the children are very happy here because they've realized, oh, shit, we have rights. You know, he can't lift a hand on me. He can't do this. I can get an income if I leave. And so a lot of the divorce rate has gone up amongst immigrants when they come because suddenly the woman feels that, you know, she has a freedom and she maybe didn't choose even that marriage. But I mean, again, we're focusing this problem to an immigrant problem, which it's not just. And it's like Diamant said, we have middle class and even upper class kids from like Täby, Djursholm, very posh areas, equivalent to Eira, you know, who are joining gangs.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And they're girls also now.
Okay.
But of course, majority are boys. And therefore, we need to discuss what is it to be a boy and a man? Or is that even relevant? How is it to be a good human being? We need to ask these philosophical questions. What is it to be? And that's what I mean by spiritual capital. Mm. Spiritual capital. So emotional capital is how do I feel? And how I feel is not who I am. Spiritual capital asks, who am I? Mm. What does it mean to be a human? So what does it mean to be a citizen of a society? Whether you're Finnish or Swedish, you should be able to be an honest contributor to society.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to contribute. And if you cannot, you find negative, destructive ways.
Right. And this is sort of hits at one of the cruxes of the issue. I'm trying not to philosophize too much about this, but a lot of the social roles, or at least the sort of archetypal social roles of men historically, are many of them more or less useless in today's modern feminine society, or more feminine society, which, I mean, I'm doing fine in it. And I also would say that I'm quite well in touch with my feminine side, or at least like whatever that means. But like, I think I am sort of generally emotionally intelligent, able to sort of have other types of conflict resolution skills than violence, able to, my work isn't hard manual labor. It's more, it's this type of stuff. Mm. And, but then I can appreciate a lot of, and also identify strongly with a lot of like, masculine sort of roles or masculine sort of expectations, at least, mm-hmm. that I think not only I put on myself, but like society historically, even now, puts on me. But I can sort of have found a nice space for myself to sort of reconcile that with modern day expectations.
It's finding that.
Yeah. But I feel like some people feel a repulsion to this sort of new type of living where things are more equal in that sense, from an older perspective, more opaque, hard to sort of interpret. Where do I belong in this sort of, where everything is equal? There are no edges and no sort of cracks anywhere.
We're not an equal, and we are never going to be equal fully.
We're never going to be similar, at least, same.
And this is the thing. People misunderstand, for example, integration with assimilation. People misunderstand getting along. So I believe in this sort of unity and diversity. I was brought up with this concept of unity and diversity. We are united, but we're different, and it's okay to be different. Mm. But we need to have a common ground of what's right and wrong.
Yeah. And then because of this repulsion towards this whatever culture, do you think that is one of the causes why people move to the other extreme? Like, I'm going to be hyper masculine if you don't even like the little part of masculinity that I've been trying to sort of...
Well, it's natural. When the pendulum is this way, it goes from one extreme to the other extreme.
Yeah.
Look at Iran. I mean, it's gone from like super religious to I don't even want to wear a hijab. I mean, it's like one... Mm. And that's how society... It does until the pendulum finds a balance. So pendulum usually goes from like, my parents used to be really strict and beat me, to I'm going to let my kids do whatever they want to. Mm. And it goes from one extreme to the other. It's a natural thing. So finding that balance, I think, is part of life. And that's why people usually find that a little bit later on in life. Mm-hmm. And so young people, it's natural for them to sort of want to test things. And
yeah. It's normal to be a little crazy when you're younger, isn't it?
And you should be.
Yeah.
And I think healthy adults should be to an extent too. Yeah. So you are meant to, but it's finding that balance. And that's why young people need tools and support in finding that. Because we know also gender has also expanded. It's not just so black and white anymore.
Yep.
So people identify in different ways. And therefore we need to sort of allow. But how much of that is important to the whole of society? There needs to be some core. You should be able to do whatever you want to do in your own time. And then there needs to be a common ground. So we don't have to completely agree, like you said, but we need to find certain things where we can say that. You see, it's like Yuval Noah Harari says very beautifully. He says that, you know, we need, it's in like in football. We have a World Cup in Qatar, and you are Finland and I'm Brazil, and we meet and we're different, and you're still Finland and I'm still Brazil, but we agree. You're going to lose now. I should have said another country, but we agree to certain rules, and therefore we can play and we follow those rules, and you're still you, you're still Finland and I'm still Sweden, but we have to agree to, and that's, you see, you can't, not only do we have internal problems in Sweden, And Finland has also its own internal problems. We know that alcohol is a big problem, domestic violence and whatnot. We know that Sweden has its own issues, which we're just talking about. But we also have a global problem. And the nation state played a very important role in, you know, 100 and 200 years ago, we became these, you know, Sweden was enemies with Skåne and Denmark just 150 years ago. So now we say we Swedes and we Finns. The concept of Finnishness is a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
So we are not Russian, we're not Swedish, we are Finns, and we actively put a, you know, lippu, we put a flag, we put a Kalevala, we put a story, we put a hero, we put a song, mm-hmm. and then we said fatherland, isänmaa, and we promoted it in school, and we fixed it. And I think that's one aspect that as a foreigner, if you come here, you can be a part of that. Mm. In Sweden, we're less apologetic. We're sort of like, oh, you know, we don't put the Swedish flag because then that's racist. Mm. And then if you come there and you're not Swedish, Swedes have never had to fight for being Swedish. So for them, it's just there. We don't even need to have our flag. We are Swedish.
It's. I saw this meme in some Swedish meme page where when there were these Quran burning controversies in Sweden, a lot of like Middle Eastern countries burned the Swedish flag as a protest in front of like embassies.
Yes.
And then a lot of Swedes are like, what do you mean you're burning the Swedish? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Swedes are so
confident in themselves.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we've never liked as Finns, is this confidence. But I mean,
but confidence in terms of like detachment from
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Like I think it's a good thing. I think it's good to be proud of your country. And I think we need to have something. Either Swedes have to become more Swedish or they need to embrace global citizenship. And we need to have a framework. We don't have a lippu and a story and a flag and a thing for global citizenship. It's a phenomenon at a global level and nobody knows at a grassroots level what that means.
Yeah.
So we need to put a framework. So if OECD has said that we're meant to be training global citizens, well, we need to then get a detailed plan. If the UN has these great resolutions, we need to know on a grassroots level how to implement them. So at this stage, we're not. And I think it's this lack of not promoting what unites us, what is common about us, our commonality, which these young people are struggling to, you know, they're trying to find this cohesion. And these immigrant kids are at the forefront because they've had to experience being different, being other.
Mm-hmm.
I have this inner reflection.
Yeah.
Why? Because I've lived in Finland as an other. But my father never said the word racism. My father never said anything. I mean, even though I was called the N-word most of my childhood, my dad never said, oh, that's racist. He said, get over it. Get on with it. You know who you are. Your sense of belonging is not dependent on others. And we just don't use that kind of language in our home. So he was just very clear about certain rules. And I think in Sweden, if we could promote our Swedishness, that's not a bad thing. But we need to also promote this diversity. And it's already there.
100%.
Sweden is already a diverse country.
Yeah. Yeah, this could keep going.
We could go on forever.
Thank you, Christina, also for joining.
Thank you so much for this and for inviting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, see you in the next episode. No, not the next episode, but the next episode. It's probably going to be on Thursday or Monday. I don't know actually when the next English language episode is going to be out, but we're going to try to book some more English language guests in the near future. If you have any recommendations, please hit us up in the comment section or somewhere else. I'll be in contact with them. Bye-bye. See ya.